Okay, try this again. Okay, welcome everybody back. And this week we're laying the Tashios of Tazia Mitzvah, the double Tashios of Tazia Mitzvah, which overwhelmingly are all about the laws related to Tzaras. I did not think that it would be a good idea necessarily to give a detailed exposition of the details of the laws of Tzaras. However, it happens to be that the laws of Tzaras contain many lessons and, many life lessons, I think, which are applicable in our everyday lives. Without getting too much into the details of Tzaras, of this skin disease which is described at length in these two parashios, as we know, Tzaras is associated by Chazal with the sin of Lashon Hara, among many other things, the sin of speaking prohibited speech, damaging speech against people. Certainly there's a lot in the laws of Lashon Hara which has practical applicability. What I wanted to do today was to speak a little bit about lessons from the two parashios of Tazria and Mitzvah, which I think are very applicable and are very relevant, and hopefully we can use in applying in our everyday lives. First of all, a little bit about the definition of Tzaras. The Torah throughout these two parashios uses the term Tzaras over and over again to describe a certain type of skin disease which is diagnosed by the Kohen, which renders the person having the skin disease tamei, ritually impure. Ultimately, he has to separate himself from the rest of the Jewish community for a period of time until he's declared to be tahor, to be pure again by the Kohen. What exactly is this condition which is referred to as Tzaras? So if you ask the average person out there, let's say if we were to go out there on Delancey Street and randomly stop people and say, excuse me, how would you define the term Tzaras? Probably the average person, if they would bother to answer the question, would say, Tzaras, oh, we all know, that's leprosy. Everybody knows that Tzaras is leprosy. And in fact, the Torah's set of laws concerning Tzaras is actually a very sophisticated medical apparatus to quarantine those who are stricken with leprosy so that they don't infect the rest of the people. If you ask a lot of people out there, they will tell you that Tzaras is leprosy, and that's the meaning, ultimately in a medical sense, of these laws which are described by the Torah. The Samson Rafal Hirsch, in his commentary on the Chumash, has a very long essay where he basically debunks this notion from top to bottom. Says Rav Hirsch, it is absolutely false to equate Tzaras with leprosy. And he speaks about it at considerable length. I'll quote a couple of his more salient points over here. Basically, writes Rav Hirsch, we find another term in the Chumash itself for leprosy. When the Torah in the Tochacha, in the admonition, describes one of the terrible diseases which will come upon the Jewish people if they don't do the word of God, it describes something called Shechem Mitzrayim, the Egyptian boils. And Shechem Mitzrayim is described as a kind of disease. Asher lusukha lehei rofe, it's a disease that strikes someone and is incurable. And it strikes the person, it strikes the person from the bottom of the feet all the way up to the skull, to the head of the person. That, says Rav Hirsch, actually is an accurate description of leprosy. Even today, leprosy is not something which is considered to be curable from a medical perspective. And that's exactly what Shin Mitzrayim is described as being. Shin Mitzrayim, Asher lo sucha lehei rofe. God will strike you with this Egyptian boils from which you will not be able to recover. There's no cure for leprosy. That stands in marked contrast to whatever Tzaras is. It's clear in the Pesukim that Tzaras is something which you can overcome. The person can be diagnosed as having Tzaras and then subsequently can be cleared of the Tzaras. Again, that alone doesn't fit the description of leprosy.
Can you move on to the 10 o'clock?
Right. So there's something. So by the way, that might give us a different interpretation of what was going on in Mitzrayim. You know, again, every Haggadah always translates Shechin as boils. Perhaps the Shechin, which the Egyptians were stricken with in Mitzrayim, actually was a form of leprosy, which again makes our appreciation of how devastating the Makos were, even deepens our appreciation of how devastating the Makos were for Mitzrayim. Imagine an entire country being stricken, even temporarily, with some kind of form of leprosy. Okay? Right, so again, that would be an exception to the rule that leprosy typically doesn't have a cure, but again, the Makos were in a universe of their own. They weren't typical in any way. The other halachos, the other laws that apply to tzaras, says the first, which make no sense if tzaras is to be referred to as leprosy. So for instance, take the following halacha. An individual is a chasam during his Sheva Brachos week, and he becomes stricken with some of the signs which we associate with tzaras. So says the halacha, don't send the Kohen in to examine him now. How's this going to work? The Kohen's going to come on the third day of Sheva Brachos, look him over, and say, buddy, you've got tzaras. You know, that's not really a way to start off married life on the right foot. Wait till he finishes Sheva Brachos, then the Kohen can go and examine him, and then if he has tzaras, so then, you know, he can be quarantined and sent out of the Jewish community in the proper fashion. Says Rav Hirsch, if the Torah was discussing this from a medical perspective, that makes no sense whatsoever. So the fellow's a chassam, but he has some kind of contagious disease. So I don't care that he's a chassam. If he's contagious, send him out as quickly as possible. What sense does it make to delay examining his condition because of the fact that, you know, he's a chassid, we don't want to share the simcha, we don't want to disturb, you know, his 7 days of happiness in some fashion or another. Parenthetically, there's an interesting vort from Rav Avram Mordechai, one of the Imre Emes, one of the Rebbes of Ger. The Imre Emes was asked the question, how is it possible for a chassan to have tzaras? Why? We know that a chassan, when he gets married, he experiences something like a Yom Kippur. So all of his sins are going to be washed away. So if tzaras is something that comes about because of sin, how much did he sin since the chasana? You know, how much of an opportunity did he have to be able to sin in order to get this tzaras? Wouldn't you think that a chasana, by definition, would have all of his sins washed away and would be incapable of getting tzaras? So the Imre Emes responded by saying, think about how Yom Kippur works. It's true that Yom Kippur serves as a kapara, as an atonement, but it only serves as a kapara for averos ben adam lamakom, for sins between the person and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yom Kippur doesn't atone automatically for sins between man and man. So what's tzaras? Tzaras is primarily something that the person got because he spoke lashon hara. Why do you think that just being a chassan is going to be a bigger kapara for that kind of sin than Yom Kippur itself would be? Yom Kippur itself wouldn't atone automatically for the sin of lashon hara. So just because the chassan has a private Yom Kippur, why should his private Yom Kippur be more powerful than the actual Yom Kippur itself? Right? It's an interesting insight. It's also worthwhile noting, I'm guessing nobody, the Shir, was ever a chassan, but it is worthwhile noting that when we talk about the chassan, I guess for that matter, the kala, you know, having a Yom Kippur on the day of their marriage and their sins being erased, Imre Emes is reminding us that that doesn't erase any sins that you have, ben adam l'chaveiro, right? You still have to make up with all your friends that aren't talking to you since you didn't invite them to the wedding. You know, you still have to make up with all of those people, you know, and make sure that you're on good terms with them. You can't just rely on the fact that you got married to be an automatic Yom Kippur, which is going to be mechaper for them in some way or another. So going back to Rav Hirsch, also points out that there are halachas in the laws of tzaras that, again, make it very, very difficult to assume that tzaras is leprosy. The halacha is that the mitzora, the person who's stricken with tzaras, is sent outside of the community, but only if he's living within a walled city. So if he's living in a walled city, he has to go outside of the walls of the city. But if he's living in a non-walled city, so he doesn't have to leave the town or the village in which he's located. Ken says that first, if the concern is medical, that, you know, we're quarantining the person in some way or another, there should be no medical difference between whether the person lives in a walled city or an unwalled city. That just doesn't make any sense from a medical perspective. Again, you have to understand why it makes sense from a spiritual perspective, but at least there's a lot to talk about. From a medical perspective, there's clearly, he's no more or less contagious depending on whether there's a wall around the city. Yeah?
Bothering himself with these important people who don't know what
to do. So Rav Hirsch had the following agenda. You know, Rav Hirsch was living in a time where he was fighting the Reform movement. And one of the claims that the Reform movement made was all of these Torah laws are antiquated. They were essentially just ancient medicine. You know, it was the ancient medicine of the ancient Jewish people just trying to deal with phenomena which they didn't fully understand because their medical knowledge was not so advanced. Now that we have modern medicine, we don't need these laws anymore. So Rav Hirsch very, very much wants to show that these laws are not simply, you know, the best attempt at medicine that they could make in the ancient world. These laws have spiritual dimensions to them, and it's a mistake to understand them simply in medical terms. That's where he's coming from. Finally, most interestingly, he writes as follows: just now, we have received the report on leprosy from the Royal College of Physicians, filed by a commission appointed by the British government to investigate the alarming increase in the number of cases of the quite common occurrence of leprosy in the British colonies. So the first rise, I got this report that was put out by the British government on leprosy. An interesting side note, at a certain point during his career, Rav Hirsch applied to be the chief rabbi of England. He did not get the position. He stayed in Germany. It's interesting to think about what might have happened had he ended up chief rabbi of England. Okay, but apparently he was reading, you know, reports on leprosy from the Royal College of Physicians in England. And the report writes as follows: the investigation resulted in the finding that leprosy, even in its most terrible form, is not at all infectious. Right? So, in other words, it's not a contagious disease, leprosy. That was the finding in the 1800s of the Royal College of Physicians in Great Britain. And Rav Hirsch goes on to quote the relevant paragraph from the study. So says Rav Hirsch, if you really wanted to debunk this correlation between Tzaraas and leprosy, we just did it. Right? Because if the perspective is that Tzaraas is leprosy, so to prevent the spread of leprosy, you know, the Torah had to take these steps in order to quarantine the Mitzorah. Well, guess what? Leprosy is not contagious. So the whole comparison doesn't make sense from beginning to end. Rav Hirsch writes, the view that the laws of Negarim or Tzaraas are sanitary regulations is merely a figment of the imagination. Right? So it's just worth, I think, stressing this for a little bit, being that even today, one does hear, I mean, again, if you open up a Hebrew-English Chumash, again, with Arskol being the notable exception, more often than not, Tzaraas is translated as leprosy, and there's a tendency to equate Tzaraas with leprosy. The first really at length shows that translation not only is not 100% accurate, it's not accurate at all. Clearly, Tzaraas is some kind of spiritual ailment which the Ribbono Shel Olam created, which no longer exists, which is a reaction to phenomena such as Lashon Hara and the like. Right, exactly. Right. I mean, the whole idea that houses would get Tzaraas, that clothing would get Tzaraas, you know, that doesn't fit in with anything we know about leprosy. So there's clearly something very, very distinct from the idea of leprosy. There's what I think is a very important passage in the Rambam at the end of the Rambam's discussion of Saras, which speaks to the basic idea of Lashon Hara. Right, again, as we said, Lashon Hara, the Gemara associates many different sins with Saras, but you know, the most common sin it associates with Saras, and what you know, the average person certainly is aware of, is that Saras comes as a result of the person speaking Lashon Hara. We know Lashon Hara is there. If you ever went to a Chofetz Chaim presentation on Tisha B'Av, you certainly know Lashon Hara is there. Question is, why is Lashon Hara bad, and why is Lashon Hara so bad that it's associated with such a terrible infliction, such as Saras? What
people get treated today is Saras?
No. But no, right. It disappeared. Right. Lashon Hara still is there, but the Saras doesn't seem to be there anymore. Right. So, but what? What is it about Lashon Hara that's so pernicious that we always talk in such terrible terms against Lashon Hara? So, again, I think the obvious answer to that question is, well, it hurts people. You know, it hurts people to say Lashon Hara about them. That's true, 100%. There's no questioning that particular aspect of Lashon Hara. But the Rambam, I think, adds a certain dimension to our understanding of what's so terrible about Lashon Hara that goes even beyond, you know, the obvious, which is that by speaking Lashon Hara, we're engaging in a terrible sin, saying Adam L'Chaveiro, and really hurting people in a very, very, you know, potentially malicious way. The Rambam, again, at the end of the laws of Saras, has a description of then how Lashon Hara brings about Saras. And he says, Lefikach, because of all of this, Roy Lamisha Rasul of having Arakav, if somebody really wants to act properly, a person should not hang out with people who speak Lashon Hara, such that a person should not be caught up in the net of evil people and their foolishness. This is how it works when you hang out with stalkers and evil people. When people get together and they're people who are not people of great character, they first speak about things that are silly. Right? Nothing pernicious, nothing malicious. Just they get together and they speak about things which are silly. When we talk cat boy in the Saturday because have Sadiqah. But somehow once they start talking about things which are silly, they move on to speak about how stupid Sadiqim are, how stupid righteous people are. Right? That's the next, can you believe he did this? They call him a Sadiq, but you know, he does X, Y, and Z. So I mean, how big a Sadiq can he be already? Right? So when we talk cat, Yelahem Hergo Adabir Benazim retains all to Dizrayim. Once people get in the habit of speaking ill of Sadiqim, the next thing they do is to speak ill of the Nevi'im, of the prophets, and to begin to doubt their words. Because, you know, after all, you know, okay, so we were always taught that Yishayahu HaNavi was a great person. But you know what? I was also taught that that other Sadiq, which I know, was also a great person. And I know he's not such a great person, but he's not such a great person, so how big could Yishayahu HaNavi have been anyway? And say, Yishayahu HaNavi wasn't such a great person, why should I listen to what Yishayahu HaNavi has to say? This is the thought process that emerges as they speak. Umitoch kach ba'in l'daber be'lokim v'kofrim v'ikra. Some talk about how the Nevi'im probably weren't right either, because, you know, how big Sadiqim could the Nevi'im have been already? So the next step that these people take is they begin to deny God himself and to make fun of the words of Hashem. In other words, the Rambam describes Lashon Hara as a progression. You know, you start off just mocking things in general. That leads you to mock Sadiqim, it leads you to mock Nevi'im, it ultimately leads the person to mock the Ribono Shel Olam. Because what the Rambam is describing, I think, is as follows. Lashon Hara and cynicism go hand in hand. When a person is accustomed to being a Lashon Hara type of person, you view the world through a cynical lens. And cynics do not have an easy time with religion. If the Rambam was writing this today, I'm sure the Rambam at some point would put the word blog into his discussion. Right? Because somehow if you have a complaint against something or somebody, be it a person, be it an institution, be it an idea, you set up a blog and you write about it and you write about it and you write about it and you get likes and friends and, you know, all kinds of good things, and that's the way the world runs, right? And that kind of attitude where a person cultivates within themselves an attitude of cynicism where, he's not really such a big tzaddik. And the Nevi'im, I don't think they were such great prophets. And ultimately, Rahman al-Islam, the person said, I'm the Ribbono Shel Olam. I don't think everything is cracked up to be the way that it's presented to be. That's this attitude of cynicism, which says the Rambam comes about when a person gets in the habit of speaking Lashon Hara. In contrast, the person who wants to be a righteous person stays away from Lashon Hara, not just because it's hurtful to people, because again, obviously it is hurtful to people, but when a person elevates his or her speech, it refocuses what you're occupied with, what you're preoccupied with. A person who's a Baal Lashon Hara gets in the habit of knocking people and institutions and ideas and ultimately the foundations of our religion down. In contrast, if a person stays away from Lashon Hara, you cultivate a non-cynical approach to the world where you look at the world and say, what can I gain in a positive way from the world? Lashon Hara is about, cultivating the opposite of a positive attitude, a positive outlook. And as Jews, fundamental to our belief system is to try to get rid of at least some of this cynicism, which is always going to be very, very poisonous in terms of our commitment to Torah Umitzvah ultimately. So it comes out, according to the Rambam, that Lashon Hara is not simply an Avera ben Adam l'Chavera, right? It certainly is that. But Lashon Hara ultimately on some level is Nazera ben Adam Lamakom. It's a sin between man and God. Because ultimately a person who speaks Lashon Hara can easily come to a scenario where they deny fundamental aspects of our belief because of that cynical attitude which they've developed for themselves. I think the Rambam gives us sort of a heightened appreciation of how terrible Lashon Hara is. According to the Rambam, again, ultimately, a person who speaks Lashon Hara can find himself very, very easily going down the path to denial of the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, because of this cynical attitude which he's managed to cultivate, in the way that he or she looks at the world. I think it's words that are worth contemplating when you speak about how terrible Lashon Hara is. A couple of lessons learned from, the psukim of Tashir and Mitzara themselves. The Torah introduces the whole discussion of Saras with the following words. Adam, ki yiyye be'or b'soro se'eish o sapachas o baheres. When an Adam, a man, a person, has in his flesh one of these different types of signs, which is a signal that he might have saras, right? And the Pasuk goes on to say, so bring this fellow, the guy looks like he has signs of saras, bring him to the Kohen will diagnose him, and, then the Torah goes on to tell us all about these halachas. Yeah. At the time of the Tanakh, yeah. Right.
Right. Why is that one thing as opposed to their,
Right. So I think it's really two things. In other words, why is it that the murderer doesn't get saras? What the Baal Lashon Hara gets saras?
You are the one who spoke Lashon Hara, whereas the
Right. So I think it's two things. The first is just going back to the Rambam, which we mentioned. You know, the Rambam is teaching us that, you know, Lashon Hara is much, much more than just, oh, you spoke not nicely about a person. You know, Lashon Hara carries within it the seeds of the person being able to deny God himself. Right? So, you know, that it's a lot worse than we might think it is, you know, off the top of our heads. Besides that, I think the difference between Lashon Hara and murdering somebody is, ironically, everybody understands that murdering somebody is wrong. But when it comes to Lashon Hara, the tendency of people is to say, well, that's just natural. You know, we all speak Lashon Hara, come on. Right, it's true, it's fine, he probably deserves it anyway. If I told you the real truth, you know, I'm not even telling you half of the truth, right, about the person. It's so... Right. Although, again, remember, there is a difference. You know, the death penalty is kind of final. You know, saras is somewhat less final. You know, in other words, it's less of a punishment and, in a sense, more of a warning. In other words, it's telling the person and the people who are part of that person's social group, you know, this is going in a bad direction. Let's correct this before it gets worse. And I think it's precisely because it's so easy to see Lashon Hara as just normal and natural that the warning has to come. You know, most normal people understand that, you know, taking a gun and shooting somebody is a bad thing. You don't have to be warned against that. Just the person who did it has to be punished in a very, very severe fashion. You know, the tzaras serves as more of a warning. You've started off on a bad direction. Correct this before it gets worse. Well, the truth is, again, we associate tzaras... Right. No. So the truth is, we associate saras primarily with Lashon Hara because that's the major sin it's associated with. But, you know, for instance, Chazal speak of that saras as being associated with asus panim, with a person being brazen. You know, if you're like a very chutzpahdik person, the Gemara says that that's a potential, you know, for saras. And even things which are stronger sins, the Gemara associates saras with adultery. You know, so in other words, there are a variety of different sins where saras would be used as a warning sign from the Ribbono Shel Olam, cease and desist, you know, pull back from these kind of sins. Lashon Hara is the most well-known of them, because I think the Gemara speaks about it most frequently, but the Gemara identifies other sins where saras would come as this kind, not as a punishment as much as a warning sign, you know, to stop doing this. So, when the Torah speaks about, and when the Torah introduces the laws of saras, it describes the recipient of saras as being an adam, right, a person, a man. We know that there are multiple ways for the Torah to express, you know, the term man or person. Ish comes to mind, right, as an example. Why is there a focus on the term adam, which arguably in the Torah appears less frequently than the term ish? So here there's a very interesting perspective which goes to a story which is about 100 years old, a story that goes back to 1912. One of the infamous occurrences in Europe in 1912 was the Mendel Bayliss trial, where he was accused, I think the last person accused, of a blood libel, of, you know, utilizing Christian blood in order to bank matzahs. And, you know, it was a celebrated case at the time. There was an attempt, you know, certainly by all of the Rabbanim and community leaders to try to come up with ways to defend Bayliss against the accusations which had been leveled at him. Among the accusations were the accusations that, was the accusation that Judaism in general is a racist religion that looks down on non-Jews. And of course, you know, even in those pre-internet days, they had people, you know, who were anti-Semites but were familiar with, you know, the Gemaras and the Midrashim and the like, and they cherry-picked, you know, many, many citations from Chazal that would prove that the Jews are a bunch of racists. They see themselves as a master race. It's somewhat ironic that this is being discussed in 1912 in Europe, right? The Jews see themselves as a master race. But in any case, you know, the all of the statements from Chazal were lined up to prove how the Jews, it's not surprising that the Jews would use Christian blood in their matzahs, because we know that the Jews look down on anyone who's not Jewish. One of the phrases which they picked out was the following quotation from Chazal. It's a real quotation. Atem kruyim adam, ve'en umos ha'olam kruyim adam. You, the Jewish people, are referred to as adam, as man, and the nations of the world are not referred to as man. And in the interpretation given to this phrase by the anti-Semitic authorities, what it meant was as follows. The Jews are saying in their own holy books, only Jews are human beings, non-Jews are subhuman. Atem kuyim adam, ve'en umas ha'olam kuyim adam. So clearly this was not a good perspective to be associated with Jews when somebody was on trial for utilizing Christian blood for matzahs, right? This did not work very well. So the great Lubluna Rav, Rav Meir Shapira, was the founder of the Daf Yomi, the founder of Yeshiva Tachmi Lublin in Lublin. So Rav Meir Shapira suggested to the defense lawyers for Bayless that they should present the following understanding of what that statement of Chazal actually means. I don't think he just meant this as a cute interpretation. I think this is how he understood it, you know, in actuality. Let's take the word ish for a moment, right? Ish means man. How do you say men in Hebrew? Anoshim, right? It's interesting, by the way, grammatically, you would think it would be ishim, right? But it's anoshim. Okay, be that as it may, there's a singular and there's a plural. Adam means man. What's the plural of Adam? There isn't. I mean, the best you get is b'nei Adam, right? But there's no Adamim or anything like that, right? Adam is a singular and a plural together. Said Rav Meir Shapira, the difference that Chazal wanted to bring out between the Jewish people and the non-Jews is that we, the Jewish people, have a sense of nationhood where we all feel responsible for one another, and we don't distinguish ourselves between a single Jew and the Jewish people as a totality. If a single Jew somewhere is in trouble, that's our problem. You said, look at this very trial with Bayless. You know, Jews are getting involved from all over the world to try to come to this man's defense. What does he have to do with me? If I'm sitting in New York, what is Mendel Bayless to me exactly? Right? So, you know, the very trial itself proves this notion that the Jewish people have a sense of interconnectedness which is really unique. Among the nations of the world, you know, okay, people feel a certain affinity for their immediate families, for their neighbors, maybe to some extent for their countrymen, but there isn't, you know, for the average person, there isn't this sense of identifying with humanity as a whole. So whatever the problems of humanity are my problems, are my issues, no, you know, the person deals with his or her limited sphere, and that's about it. Said Rav Meir Shapira, that's what Chazal meant, Atem kruyim Adam, you, the Jewish people, are referred to as Adam. Adam in the sense that you don't distinguish between the singular and the plural. The Ein Umos Ha'olam Kuyim Adam, we don't mean to say that non-Jews are not considered to be human beings, we don't mean that they're subhuman, but that unique status of Adam, where there's no difference between the singular and the plural, that doesn't exist in the non-Jewish world to the extent to which it exists in the Jewish world. In the non-Jewish world, it's Ish and Anoshim, right? Isha and Noshim, right? Only within Klal Yisrael do we have the sense that every Jew is an integral part of the whole, and Adam, singular, plural, is exactly the same thing. Oh, so earlier, about half a century before Rav Meir Shapira, the author of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch used this basic idea in explaining the pasuk which we just quoted. Right? The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch was Shlomo Gansfried. He was a rav in Hungary in the 1800s. he's most well known for having put out the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, because that's the sefer that won him fame, you know, the abbreviated form of the Shulchan Aruch. But the truth is, he authored many, many other far before the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. One of the svarim which he wrote was a sefer on Chumash called Apir Yom. Okay, so that's the Apir Yom of the Baal Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. In that commentary, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the Rosh Hashanah Street says as follows. Why does the Torah introduce the laws of Saras with Hodom Kiyye Boar Besaro Se'efo Sakacha? So he says something very, very similar to what Rav Meir Shapiro would say, again, about a half a century later. Hodom is a term which implies the interconnectedness between people. Right? Because it's a term that has no distinction between singular and plural. When a person speaks Lashon Hara, and therefore brings upon himself the signs of Tzara'as, he's damaging the notion of Adam, because he's driving a wedge between people. He's taking what should be one organism, you know, one unit, Adam, and he's breaking up Adam into little pieces. You know, he's making of Adam Anoshim, you know, separate individuals, as opposed to being one unified whole. Hence, when the Torah introduces the laws of Saras, it starts off with the word Adam, so as to say, you know, if you've been speaking Lashon Hara and contracting Saras, obviously your appreciation for this whole concept of Adam is flawed, is lacking in some way or another. There's another beautiful, we mentioned the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch with Shlomo Ganzfried, he has another beautiful insight into the Parshios of Pasriya Metzora. This one, you know, we introduced what he says at the beginning of Parshas Pasriya. The second insight of Shlomo Ganzfried comes at the beginning of Parshas Metzora. So there at the beginning of Parshas Metzora, the Torah describes how the person who has experienced Tzaraas but is in the process of being purified from his tzaraas, what is the ceremony which he undergoes to finally show that he's free of tzaraas and that he can re-enter the Jewish community, he can bring karbanos once again, and he can resume the life that he had before he was stricken with tzaraas. So the Torah describes there in the beginning of Parshas Metzora that his road back to rehabilitation involves two birds. He takes two birds. Again, you'll read the beginning of Parshas Metzora. He takes two birds. One bird is sent away. The other bird is shechted, it's slaughtered, and its blood is utilized to touch various parts of the Metzora's body. And that's part of the purification process which he undergoes in order to rehabilitate him and bring him back into the Jewish fold. Why birds? Why would one bring in birds over here? So Rashi quotes from Chazal that birds chatter. Right? Baruch Hashem, we have a beautiful spring day today. If you want to test the truth of this, you can walk outside after this year. You'll hear the birds chirping and chattering. Says Rashi, again quoting from Chazal, you know, this fellow, this Mitzora, got himself into hot water by doing too much chirping and chattering himself. He was a little bit of a chatterbox. You know, that's clearly how he got himself into this position. He was going around speaking Lashon Hara. So the birds are utilized in his purification process to remind him, you got to watch your mouth. You know, you can't be constantly just chirping and chattering like the birds. You have to be a little bit, you have to muzzle yourself a little bit and not say everything that crosses your mind. So the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, or Shlomo Ganzfried, quotes this statement from Rashi, and he says, okay, I get that, but why two birds? Right? In other words, if you want to make the point that the Baal Lashon Hara, you know, the person who was speaking Lashon Hara was a little bit too bird-like in his approach to life, you know, constantly chirping and chattering and always talking and talking and talking and talking. So just have one bird. Why not two birds? And moreover, right. Right. Huh?
And
Oh, okay. So it could be, you know, that's the before and the after, right? You could explain it like that. Rav Shlomo Gottfried has the following slightly different approach to it. Again, it's not to say one's right, one's wrong, but he presents the following, and the idea, I think, is a very powerful idea. So says Rav Shlomo Gottfried, so what's supposed to be the correction of somebody's about lashon hara? So a person might be inclined to say, okay, I'll become a monk, you know, talking gets me into trouble. So, you know, I'll go, for the rest of my life, I'll pretend that it's between the Tilos Yodayim and Hamotzi. You know, right? I'll go the rest of my life like that. If talking gets me into problems, so, you know, maybe I should, at the very least, minimize the amount that I'm going to talk. Comes the Torah and says, no, talking is a beautiful gift that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us. The point that the Torah wants to impress upon us is not don't talk. The Torah wants to impress upon us use our speech wisely. So there are two birds, says the Shlomo Gottfried. Talking is good. We're not anti-bird. You know, we're not anti-chirping. We're not anti-chattering. But we're anti the use of speech in a negative way. So there are two birds. One bird gets shechted, that's the bad speech, the lashon hara. The other bird is sent out to be free because that's the lashon hatov. We are supposed to engage in speech. Speech obviously can be used for Torah, for tefillah. Speech can be used for tremendous chasadim. A person comes to you and they want to talk about a problem that's really bothering them. You know, if you just sit there, well, I mean, sometimes people do that, you know, but that's not really the most effective way to deal with their problem. Really? You don't say, right? You know, no, you're supposed to engage them in some way that's meaningful in order to help them get past the problem.
So,
I'm sorry? They kill the bird first because you have to
prove.
Right. 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 Well, I guess if you don't have anyone to talk to, then you can talk as much as you want. Right. Right. Then you just pretend to talk on your phone the whole day, you know, so you feel like you have friends. Right. 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 Right, 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 100%. But the Torah is from the Gansu is bringing out with this idea with the two birds is that, you know, the Torah is not, the antidote to Lashon Hara is not to stop speaking. You know, it's not to look at speech inherently as being something evil. Again, let's go back to the Rambam, which we quoted at the very beginning of the Shir today. The Rambam speaks about the way people who are Bali Lashon Hara speak. They speak in a way which invites cynicism. And the Rambam then says, not, so therefore don't speak. The Rambam says, about sichas tzadikim, the conversation of tzadikim, or those who aspire to be tzadikim, is different. In other words, you're not supposed to get rid of speaking, you're supposed to elevate and raise the level of your conversation. They say, I'm not sure who says it, but they say, you know, I'm not sure you just attribute it today, and probably somebody says it, but people who are not so spiritually sophisticated talk about other people. People who are more spiritually sophisticated talk about ideas. Right? And, you know, that's something to aspire to. When you sit down and you talk with people, is it just about this one and that one, and this one's doing this, and this one's doing that? Okay, you know, there's a certain amount of that just makes us normal and social that we talk about what other people are doing. But, you know, when we get together with other people, do we ever talk about, you know, ideas? Do we ever talk about values? Do we ever talk about things that are more abstract? You know, do we talk about aspirations? What's that? Right, right. Yeah, but I sometimes if we try to sit down and talk about values and ideals and aspirations, we run out of things to say very quickly because, yeah, I never really thought about those things, right? So part of what Lashon Hara, you know, part of what all these parshiyos are supposed to instill in us is not stop speaking, but maybe change the topics that you talk about. or at least moderately change the topics that you talk about so that you can talk about ideals as opposed to talking about, you know, other people and what they're doing. People are human. People want to talk about something. That's the way we connect with other people. But you can connect with other people by talking about people, or you can connect with other people by talking about ideals and values. And, you know, the more we can move our conversation in that direction, you know, ultimately the better people we will become as a result. Right. 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 Now that's why I find the Rambam principles just to be very striking, because the Rambam, it's hard to imagine that the Rambam would deny that Lashon Hara is about the Adam L'Chaveiro as well. I mean, it clearly is on some very basic level. But the Rambam is saying, look at also where Lashon Hara is going to take you. You're going to be the kind of person who becomes a cynical person, and cynical people ultimately, you know, cynical people and religion don't really go very well together, because, you know, when people are cynical, you know, nothing can be right. Everything's wrong. Everybody's wrong. You know, I know better than everybody else. You know, I'm the only one who's smart in the entire world, right? You know, that's where the attitude of Lashon Hara is ultimately going to take a person, and that's an attitude that will bring the person down in a very, very severe fashion. Okay, so take a home lesson from today. Don't speak Lashon Hara. And Be'ezus Hashem, we'll see everybody next week.